Welcome back to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. There are at least as many bacterial cells in your body as there are human cells. And there's a growing recognition that they're critical for everything from digestion, obviously, to mental health, maybe not so obviously. They also play a big role in immunity, our ability to fight off diseases. But the relationship isn't always easy or friendly. For all the good they do, if gut bacteria get into the wrong places, it can be problematic. So, how do we keep them in their place? And then, how do they talk to the rest of our body? Those are questions Laura Hooper is trying to answer with her research. She's a professor in the Department of Immunology at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas. Laura, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
There's been a big push in the past few years to kind of more widely get people to recognize the good that bacteria do, not just, you know, be all out at war with bacteria, actually maybe do things to nourish the good bacteria in our bodies. But in actual fact, this is kind of a war of containment. We've got to keep those gut bacteria in the right place. So what happens if they get out of the gut, get into other parts of the body?
Well, at worst, you can end up with a raging infection, which can lead to sepsis, and which can be deadly. And that can happen during surgery, for example. You know, when you have surgery on the gastrointestinal tract, that's a real risk. Your gut bacteria sort of get out of the gate and invade your body, and bad things happen. But when they're contained where they're supposed to be, they do a lot of good. And their main contribution to our health is to our metabolic health. So they help us break down a lot of substances in our diet that would be otherwise not easily digested, like things like, you know, plant polysaccharides. So components of plants. So if you eat a salad, you're eating a lot of different complex carbohydrates. Your bacteria help you break that down and make it calorically beneficial. Now, in our day and age, we might think of that as not such a great benefit. But in the past, when we were more acquiring food was more challenging, of course, having bacteria that could help you digest and make the most of your diet would have been perhaps the difference between life and death. So you can understand how these relationships co-evolved over many millennia.
So how do we keep those gut bacteria where they're supposed to be in the gut?
Right. So that's what we've been learning a lot about over the past decade and a half in my lab. And it's really fascinating. So the scale of the problem is really immense. You have up to 100 trillion bacteria in your gut, and the surface area of the gut is absolutely enormous. It could cover a football field. So
Wow. You
have a lot of, you're very vulnerable. So there has to be, so the immune system, most of your immune system actually lives in your gut for that reason, because that's where the threat is the highest.
And I once had someone tell me actually that your kitchen sink is more dangerous than your toilet, in all likelihood, because you're going to find more of the foodborne pathogens
right.
are actually more dangerous than what's coming out the other end.
I like that. I'm going to use it in my lectures. So there has to be a lot of effort and energy put into defending your borders. So you have a very thin layer of epithelial cells, basically a lining that covers the entire surface of the intestine. And one thing that we've discovered is that when your epithelium senses that too many bacteria are getting too close, there are little sort of burglar alarms positioned on this lining, and they fire off a series of signals to the epithelial cell nucleus, and you get expression of proteins that actually are like little antibiotic bombs. So they glom onto bacteria, and they actually cause these bacteria to die, to lyse, to burst their membranes. So, they're pretty potent. And so that's one defense that we have against bacteria. So
we do that to any bacteria, right? Whether it's the good gut bacteria that should be there or an infectious bacteria.
Yes, that's a very important sort of concept that's a little difficult to understand, that sort of emerged in the field over time. It used to be thought that, well, your cells would not detect good bacteria, but they would detect bad bacteria. But if you think about it strictly in terms of location, you can see that the good bacteria can become bad. And bad bacteria might not be particularly bad if they're in the in the right place. So it's more like a proximity sensor mechanism. So if these bacteria get too close to epithelial cells, that's when this mechanism gets fired. And yes, everybody gets killed, good and bad.
Well, and you've called that kind of a demilitarized zone, right?
That's right.
That you've got the human intestinal cells, you've got the layer of bacterial cells, and then in between, you've got this kind of no man's land.
That's right. And that it's defined by something that is, you know, something we talk about in the seventh grade, which is mucus. So it's not just your nasal passages that make mucus, but your entire gastrointestinal tract makes a lot of mucus, and it forms kind of a thick layer at the surface of this intestinal lining. Sort of, you can think of it like flypaper. So bacteria will kind of get stuck in the outer layers and your inner that. You know, very delicate inner epithelial layer is protected. So if bacteria do penetrate into the mucus layer too deeply and get too close to your epithelial cells, that's when these little antibiotic bombs can be deployed to keep them out. So they sort of protect this mucus layer. And you see, you can visualize it. If you actually go under the microscope and see where the bacteria are, you see this little, what we call the demilitarized zone. There are a few bacteria there, but not many. They're mostly kind of stuck on the flypaper of the mucus.
Okay, so assuming everything's going right, you've got a layer of intestine, a layer of mucus, a layer of bacteria, and those bacteria are, as you said, digesting a lot of food, but they're also mediating processes we're now learning all throughout our body. How do they communicate through that, those layers, that demilitarized zone and all the other layers they have to get to the rest of our body?
Well, the short answer is we don't really know, and we're learning. We know a lot about how our cells detect bacteria. So in other words, what are the burglar alarms that can go off? We know less about the kinds of molecules that our bacteria may be using to communicate with us in other ways that are, you know, not immunological. For example, bacteria make a lot of metabolic byproducts, you know, small molecules that might be quite useful. They might be involved in triggering organ development or even, you know, impacting how our brain develops, how we think. I mean, this is very, very early days of that field, so I don't want to say too much about it. But these tiny molecules can sort of move easily, you know, across these thick barriers and even into epithelial cells and beyond and have a lot of effects. I can't be more specific because we just don't know much, but there's a very complicated set of molecular signals that are being exchanged between us and our bacteria, for sure, and the communication flows both ways.
Meanwhile, in the gut, the bacteria are not only, you know, kind of mildly at war with our own intestine, but with each other. There's constant competition, you know, between the good bacteria and the bad bacteria, or maybe just, you know, I just want to be the dominant bacteria. So they're at war with everybody around them. And one of the weapons that they use are viruses.
Yes. Yes. Bacteria are just like people. A lot of times they fight with each other. So and there's some
except that most of us, I don't think, are willfully producing viruses to infect others. Right?
No, so, we don't do that, but we use other weapons.
So how do bacteria actually produce viruses and target them to other bacteria?
So that's a very interesting phenomenon, and this is something we've worked on. A very talented postdoc in my lab, Breck Durkop, who now has his own lab at the University of Colorado, discovered that bacteria make it's been known for a long time that bacteria make special viruses called bacteriophage. They don't attack our cells; they only attack other bacteria, and usually the bacteria that make these bacteriophage, or phage as we call them in the lingo, they themselves are immune, but they can be used to attack a rival bacterial species or a different strain of the same bacteria. And you can imagine that might be beneficial when, you know, these two species of bacteria are competing for the same nutrients. So you might not want your rival to be around to access your nutrient supply, so you just kill them off with these phage.
Does that have a beneficial effect, I guess, side effect for us as humans, that our gut bacteria are constantly working to kill off other bacteria that might be pathogenic, that might be disease causing for us?
I would love to know the answer to that question, but this field, in terms of understanding how these phage impact our populations of gut bacteria and how that might relate to health and disease is so new. And that I think that's something that's going to come out in the coming years, but we don't know anything yet. But I suspect the impact will be profound.
A lot of really cool questions.
Yeah.
The way that you get at answers for some of these, mm-hmm. One tool you have, are these germ-free mice,
yes.
Mice that have no gut bacteria. Now, if we go on the assumption that our gut bacteria are critical to our health, how do these mice even make it? Are they a total mess?
That's a great question. So actually, Louis Pasteur, who was the father of microbiology, wrote a little paper in 1885 asking that exact question. Nobody had germ-free animals at that point, but he thought a lot about not just pathogens or bad bacteria, but he thought a lot about the normal communities of bacteria that he knew lived on animals. And he sort of proposed, before anybody else started thinking about this, that they were essential for life. And he, in this very interesting paper that he wrote, he said that he would love to make a germ-free animal and see if they were absolutely essential for life or not. He said, I don't think this experiment will work because I think once the animals are germ-free, they will die. And so, interestingly, a lot of people, very persistent people, took up this question. And for the next 50 years, people tried and failed to make animals germ-free, to remove all the microbes and raise them in completely microbiologically sterile conditions. But ultimately, they succeeded in the 1930s and 40s. Two groups, one in Sweden and one in the United States, did this. And it wasn't just with small animals. They had big animals, you know, big farm animals that they were able to drive into germ-free conditions. So this was Louis Pasteur was uncharacteristically wrong about this. So so it is true that our microorganisms are essential for our health. They are essential for our metabolic health. We don't function at our highest level metabolically without them. However, they are not required for life. And if you are sort of confronted with bad bacteria, it's really much better to have your own home team, there in place, because they keep those bad bacteria, you know, out of your gut, out of your nasal passages and so forth. And also they stimulate your immune system. So your immune system is sort of, you know, on ready alert because they have to defend against these resident bacteria. And so they're as a consequence, they're on alert for anything truly nefarious that might come through.
So life is better with bacteria, but we might be able to make it without.
Exactly right. It wouldn't be a life worth living, in my opinion.
Laura Hooper of the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas, thanks so much.
You're welcome, and thanks for having me.
Until next week, this is Living Lab Radio. You can always find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab is produced by Heather Goldstone and Elsa Partan. Mindy Todd is the executive producer. Major support for Living Lab comes from the Candida Fund.